So more than 20 years ago, Martha Acosta and I did the Fundamentals of Human Performance class for the Department of Energy at Los Alamos National Laboratory. We developed and wrote it. Martha and I did it together. Martha was amazing. She's a really good course developer. And then we early on met Bob and Andrea. And so we've been doing this a really long time. And I wanted to see if it was worth getting together and talking about what it felt like at this point that the journey's advanced as far as it has. But I don't want this to appear like we're self-inflating or egotistical, because it's not that at all. I mean, not even close. But I was curious what these people were thinking, because these ideas, when we thought them up years ago, they were just these ideas. When Tony Machara and Rob Fisher and because the whole gang, there were a whole bunch of us, Shane Bush. These are all names you probably know. I'm forgetting so many people. We were just getting started on this journey. I wondered if they were as surprised as I was that a lot of these ideas are becoming more and more mainstream.
No sound.
Everybody, pre-accident investigation safety moment. No, it's not safe. What is wrong with me? It is not safety moment. This is a full-blown podcast. It's going to go on way longer than you even probably think it should. That's how long this is. I'm so glad to be here. How are you? I hope you're doing well. It's a great opportunity to get together and check in on each other and enjoy the conversation, talk about the progress, you know, just kind of being cool, groovy friends. In a cool, groovy way. That's our goal. And I hope things are going well. Pretty good here. No complaints. Just chugging along, making sure stuff's happening, seeing what's next. You know, the drill. That's what we do. We have some fun. Today's pod is interesting because it's going to be Martha Acosta, Bob Edwards, Andrea Baker, and myself. And we're going to talk about sort of the origins of some of these early ideas. I would love to have had Tony Machara and Rob Fisher, Shane Bush, Bill, Cindy Wagner. There's a whole crowd of us that would have been really fun to get together to have this conversation. Because when we started this journey all those years ago, who would have known that all these years later, these ideas would all have legs and companies are improving and getting better and fewer people are dying and good work is being done and workers have a voice. And I mean, it's kind of an exciting time to be alive. And as these ideas get more and more mainstream, I was curious. I wonder what those guys are thinking, because I was wondering what I was thinking. I didn't really have a good bead on it. I mean, I try to sort of one banana peel away from, you know, moving forward throughout my entire life. I'm not a big plan guy. I think I probably have relatively significant commitment issues. I don't even buy like big cartons of milk. I mean, you know, because what if something happens? So I wondered if they thought the way I was thinking, that some of these ideas are really kind of springing forth. Like, the thing I think about all the time, and I bet I talk about it in this interview, is how I wish we would have named learning teams something else. But that's what we called them at Los Alamos, was learning teams. But now we have to live with the name learning team. Not that it's a bad name or anything, but I would have called it like, you know, Delta Force or, I don't know, something exciting. Steel meeting. Change. Convention. I don't know. I would have thought of a sexier name because that would have been cooler. But we didn't. And then they kind of stuck. And now there's books written about them, many books written about them, and people do them. And there's experts out there and people who are way better at doing it than I would ever even know how to do them. I mean, it's kind of exciting to see where that goes. And that is kind of what this podcast is all about. It's a conversation among friends, for sure. You'll sense that almost immediately. And we've known each other a long time. And it's kind of a conversation on how the origins existed and how that makes us feel. So sit back and relax, see what you think. It may not be for everybody, but I think you might find this kind of interesting. Okay, so the question I'm dying to ask you is, after sitting through the last 3 days, and you three guys are really a good group to ask this of, how does it make you feel to see your words on that screen so many times? All three of you. I mean,
you're not recording it.
Yeah, I'm totally recording.
Should I?
Well, wait, I should say this. I think I'm recording. I'm not certain. How does it make you, because I was dying. I sat there tonight or this afternoon and thought, I've just, my mind was just going backwards, backwards, backwards to, I mean, how does it make you feel?
That 20 years ago.
These are words that, I mean, I'm pretty sure I'll never use this, but we kind of made all this up.
Well, I mean, it's not really that we made this up. I mean,
the terminology, though, much the terminology.
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah, that's right. I don't think the ideas are solid and hold their own, and I think are empirically sound, and there's good data.
Years and years and, but, years, and years of understanding.
But it's the language. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like they're repeating our typos. Doesn't it? I mean, I don't know how else to say it.
Well, so actually, the thing that it makes me feel, I don't know if we should use this. I don't know how openly I should speak.
I know, the same way, but I thought, I'm going to record this because I just thought, we have to talk about this.
We literally have the back and forth emails and slides and stuff from kind of years before this stuff was
said
publicly.
I know.
It was like wrestling through and sharing with other people.
Like when they said, thanks, Beth Lay and Grover Tree or whatever for the, was the worker surprise question. And I was like, really? I mean, not that I care, but remember when we crafted the questions leaders should ask? And
it actually came when I've been at Roper.
Yeah, I mean, they just met, and we just were like, well, let's ask these.
Is the system stable? Is mm-hmm.
it yeah.
Yeah.
So the overwhelming feeling that I get is one of, I don't even know if I know the right words. It's one where I
tried in German.
It's one where I feel two things, I think, which they compete with each other in my head, that this is exactly what we were hoping would happen, meaning that
it would help,
that people would see something different and feel so empowered by it that it becomes how they think, and therefore how they speak, and therefore becomes the origins of the words. They don't mean anything. Like, there's no reason to know the origins of the words because they just feel fundamentally like truth.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, in order to change the structure of an organization, you have to have quite a few people feeling as though the truth they are living under is maybe different from what they felt before. And so it is absolutely the thing that we're like, hey, this makes a ton of sense. This would be a moment to look at, to say that we've been able to help accomplish something. But in the same regard, it's terrifying because you can see how people will mimic language, and quite quickly, given the right conditions, that something that honestly, the terminology itself was completely fabricated.
Just made up.
Now has meaning
yeah.
to people. And then you kind of realize that that's just how the world works.
Mm-hmm.
And you just maybe never got the seat at the table to see that that is how all of the things that we see, not all of them, are created. But that's
the I would think most people aren't invited to that seat. I think we were fortunate or unfortunate. I don't know.
Well, and I mean, I think, you know, the reason why those words are meaningful is because they're associated with something that worked and that resonated with people. So, like, I was looking through a box and I found the handbook that we created at Los Alamos.
Yeah, the spiral one?
The spiral handbook.
Yeah,
and how much trouble we got into printing that in color, because I wanted it printed in color because I did all that work to find. Yeah, I know. And I actually, for some reason, kept one and stuck it in a box.
It's a pretty good little document.
It's a pretty good little document. And so, and there's a lot of that, a lot of the stuff that is now in this hot movement And we didn't call it that back then. And I, you know, and I haven't really been involved in this until you wrote me in during really more or less.
I've been the spirit of what you did is carried through.
Well, yeah, but I sort of, but I feel like I went to Mars and came back and like, wait, this is my, like you go away and you live far away and then you come back home and you're like, oh, I mean, this is really still my home. Like I still know these people. Mm-hmm. I still understand this culture. But I mean, my feeling, if it's this stuff has pervaded, is, oh shit, it worked. Because when we first tried this, I mean, what we were trying to do was stand up, get Congress to believe that we could stand up a failed operation, a failed nuclear operation, or what was perceived as a perceived failed nuclear operation, that we could stand it up and not fuck it up.
Yeah.
Right. So we had just created this, I think this will work and maybe they'll buy it. And this definitely seems, this is a different way, a radically different way to approach this than how we've approached it before. And so it feels like it was a little experiment that worked.
It didn't feel like it was to me. And it's not so much, I don't know how you guys feel. Like, I don't. So it's been kind of weird this week because there's so many ownership arguments. Well, I invented this and I'm the first person to say, and I did it. So I don't really like care about any of that stuff. That's just tedious. Right. But I think it's hilarious that the origin stories are kind of just being created in thin air. I mean,
it's
I had a person we know say, well, you know, we invented the term hop. And I wanted to say, man, Kurt Krueger would be so hurt right now because I could tell you where the word hop comes because it rhymed with that stupid hop to shop program. Do you remember this? I mean, and you know,
I remember when you told me, oh, well, we're calling it hop now. And I was like, that sounds stupid. Well,
because I can't let go of HPI. The one that cracks me up the most, it just cracks me up, is how learning teams is stuck. That is the dumbest name. That is the dumbest name. That's always been the dumbest name. It's just a dumb name.
And I see Bob keep trying to drive operational learning.
There's a much better name for it.
He makes it the title of everything and everybody's learning team.
But you know it's not going to go because they're in love with that stupid.
But actually it is going. Did you notice how many times operational learning was said?
Well, that's good.
In conjunction with. So, but
because learning team couldn't be stupider. It's a completely made up term.
Todd, but remember, once again, we needed a change.
Yeah.
Our investigations were so harsh. People were terrified by them. We were not learning much. You and I had an argument in the hallway about a guy who ran a forklift onto a, right? And I sent home for 3 days.
It started with a black lock.
It started with a black lock. But it really got really, I mean, the first learning team we did was that very first, that was the first week you were there.
Yeah.
And you and I stood in the hallway and argued. I said, yeah, but he broke a rule. And you said, Bob, are you willing to learn?
Think about how much impact Lisa Brooks has had. If we had a penny for every time they said black line, blue line.
Yep. So that was a conversation with me and Lisa because we had all these things.
And all she said was you have to make it consistent.
Yep.
The lines used to be whatever color marker I had. So the whole time in Los Alamos, they were always whatever marker started. Yep. That was perceived work. Yep. Whatever marker was next
was
the actual work.
But it actually,
and then whatever the third marker color I could find, which at Los Alamos means it's probably green, red, black, was risk. Yep. And
but it was needed, right? Because it was
Decker said blue line, black line. Decker said blue line, black line.
I know, it's so, to me, the whole thing is very encouraging that it helps, right? I think all of us, if we see something that we put our heart into. And our brains into, and our collective effort into it. And we're like, wow, this is actually helping. That's what was really encouraging to me.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, you're absolutely right. And that's the conversation we should have. But the conversation I'm interested in having is how do you feel?
You know, there's one thing though that, you know, since I did a little time travel that I can't believe is still a problem, which is the blame. problem. I kind of thought that was like the easiest, like, duh thing to deal with. And the fact that we are still talking about it for forever, that sort of is amazing to me.
It's part of human. It's just part of who we are. It's part of right. We're going to be fighting against it for forever.
More that we recently, as I said, we love the principles. Can we drop the second one? Because we have to do too much explaining. We're on that wave. No, that's the reason.
No, that was the first. That was the first one at Los Alamos.
Well, the funny thing is that whether to put blame before error or error before blame, it's still a struggle in my brain because. Yeah. You can't talk about blame if you don't talk about error. You have to talk about error because you have to build the case that error is not a choice.
Right.
So then you talk about blame, but you can't really talk about blame. I mean, you can't really talk about error if you don't talk about blame. So you got to talk, you really talk about both, but you have to make them separate enough so they feel different.
Right.
So.
And then the other account, oh, sorry. No, go ahead. I was going to say then the accountability conversation. Remember when we were sitting with John Sung and Steve Yarbrough?
I can still tell you what our definition is. Do you remember it?
Accountability, a partnership. And there
was a handshake. I wanted a handshake, but I didn't get it.
Right.
The worker does good work and leadership provides the right support. I mean, that
yeah.
It's not,
it was something like
that.
That's
not so accurate, but.
But it was kind of, yeah. We fought about like, well, does leadership create the context? And we just, and that was the whole thing. And now, I mean, we're still there. We are still talking about accountability. And my big aha in doing my accountability workshop was that the black line still dominates the definitions of accountability.
To an extent, the big aha for me recently in accountability has been the fact that accountability is always a group dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
We treat accountability as if it's an individual value, but accountability only exists in a group.
Right.
It's only a relational value. And right. So then you have all that stuff,
right,
which is really interesting. That's the exciting stuff. Like the fact that we're constantly learning new stuff, that's what keeps us sane. I mean, clearly we wouldn't
be like Groundhog Day.
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly we wouldn't.
We are doing things and saying things differently than when we first started.
Oh, for instance, there's a lot of stuff I just wouldn't bother,
irritability
and the performance modes are interesting, but not terribly important.
Yep.
I mean, I've told you,
we've left
they're
a
really
lot of
good if you
behind.
Have to kill 37 minutes. You need to kill 37 minutes.
Yeah.
Bring that up.
6 years ago. So I looked at it slide that from like 6 years ago. And I would say that 50% of the things that I started talking about, I don't talk about anymore. And you have warned me with sometimes, you know, you get excited about something new that you're learning and you want to integrate it into it. But when I went back to go try to teach them again, I think that it's probably a combination of that, but then also the recognition of doing it a bunch of times that that wasn't the takeaway that I wanted people to have. They were grabbing the information and doing something with it that I was like, that is not what I personally believe we should be.
Right. Well, and that's one of the riskiest parts of this is that I thought Lisa was quite good about that, mm-hmm. is that you go and teach the class that you're teaching, not the class that they're needing. Which is, that's the whole origin of the five principles, is that nobody was teaching fundamentals. I mean, and they still, it's better now, but there was a period of time there where people, they were going straight to tools. Yep. Well, we know that will fail. Yep. I mean, we know we have tons of it.
Well, and the fact that we all, you know, what are the slides that every presentation had? Some sort of five principle slide and some sort of black line, blue line slide. Yeah. That right there says that you were right. The fundamentals need to be taught over and over and over again.
Well, you know where that comes from, right? That's Kellen Wilson, the director of chemistry at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. Never let go of first principles.
Yeah.
Right. The minute you let go of first principles, you're no longer teaching chemistry. And I was like, oh, we should probably learn that lesson. And he says, oh, I have to learn it every couple of years. So,
you know. Yes. We will, when we start seeing fractals in Andy's classes, we are going to have to pull her out, have a little chat.
But is there, are you proud?
No, I don't know how you feel because you were asking us, but you're a baby. Yeah. And you have seen your.
So we have a little community that we, that's not exclusive. Anyone can be a part of it. It's just we've been around a long time. I would love if in this room with Shane Bush, if somebody had Lisa Brooks in here, although we'd have to have lots more microphones, but we could do that. Well, not today, but I would love to have some of the, like, it'd be really interesting.
And Earl.
Earl would be a treat because he could just, I just think he wouldn't believe it. I mean,
yeah.
Because when we started early on, like with GE, the reason GE has this is Cindy Wagner.
Yeah.
And Cindy Wagner brought it in to her Nuke Fuels people. Yeah. And Kurt Krueger was just like, oh, what is this? And then it went to that ORC thing, which Kurt Krueger was like double secret Batman of. And then we were off to
you
the
races. You know office. How we got involved was because
Lisa
Brooks was at our session.
I totally know how come you got involved.
And she could like feel our frustration. And she literally walked up to me and Scott O and said, have you ever heard of this thing called HOP? And we had not. And next thing you know, you're visiting us.
She was supposed to look for two sites.
Yep. And there was two. We wanted them.
A hard site and an easy site. Okay. And I honestly don't know.
Yeah,
but I don't know. She never told me.
So one of them was one that was really struggling to even survive, and we were the money making machine. But we were lean, Six Sigma, VPP, right? We had all this stuff. We were early adopters of everything, and known for that. And we made more money at my one site than all the rest of it. I think all the rest of the sites put together in appliances. And so she's like, "Let's go there too if they want it." She didn't make us; she offered. And then we had not already got started, and then we meet these crazy folks over in aviation.
Aviation.
And Andrea meets us and says, I'm in.
Well, the other site they took us to early with the that relationship was the health, I have no idea what it's called. They made intubation tubes. Have I told you the story? It's in New Jersey. It was a GE facility. And they made these tubes that had a tube with a tube in the middle. Mm-hmm. So it's two tubes.
Two tubes. Yeah.
But they're super common. Like every surgical center in the world uses them because you need air to go in and suction to go out. It's for the lungs, right? Mm. And the first time we met with them, God, that was an interesting place. So it's a little tiny factory, probably 200 employees. And the leadership team was mostly sales. And they said, well, you know, we want to be very GE, world class. Best in whatever you guys, GE term you use, best in the, not best in business, but best in class or whatever term they were using at GE that week. I was there when Health Ahead came in because they went from the best bacon sandwich.
You so much about that.
The bacon sandwich was amazing. It was amazing.
And the rice, what were the things called?
Rice cakes.
Yeah,
they said, we want to be the world-class intubation tube manufacturer or best in class. And I just said, well, how many people make these? And they're like, well, we have the exclusive patent. We're the only place in the world. And I'm like, well, we're done. There's nobody better than you because you're the only ones that make them. But that place was really interesting because they thought that would be really hard because they were struggling bad. And that was the one where the first time we went on the floor, they were using stacks of newspaper on the back of their all-pack machine. And I was like, do you not have tables? And they're like, well, yeah, but – I mean, this works. And I'm like,
what's cool about that experiment, Todd, was that it worked with the site that was super efficient, super. It also worked with the site that was struggling to just make it.
Like the opposite of super efficient, under efficient. Like the first thing they did was buy plastic tables at Target. They didn't even have that. What's that crap you guys use at Roper, thing that where you could make anything? Yeah. They didn't even have that. They were crazy.
Yeah, so I'm going to tell you how I feel. Because you asked, is that we
did? Well, I did ask that question.
I know. I was giving you all these logical reasons, blah, blah, blah. But how I actually feel, first of all, I'm super, super proud and humbled at the same time. It's like, oh my word, there's so many people that this is helping. So to be a small part of that feels like meaningful, right? Like I used to like designing products, except guess what? As soon as you design the product, now somebody's designed a better one over there and you got to beat them. So it was fine, but it didn't give you that same sense of, wow, I think this is actually really helping people in the workplace. Maybe it's kind of growing, and then it's kept growing. And then we're at a conference in Wollongong, wherever that is, and 600 people came here from 150 companies. That's pretty exciting. Yeah. And so you see anything that I might have had some influence in up there, it just feels, it feels warm and wonderful, and it's just awesome. So it's good to be a part of it.
Isn't it wild? Who would have thought?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I feel.
I mean, how do you feel? Did you answer?
I did.
You kind of did. Well, it was a little bit clinical.
Well, and you put it back on you.
Very well,
you
know, I don't know how I feel.
I mean, I really don't. I let me say that the fact that there are this many people here talking about this, that makes me feel warm and proud and happy. And like all of the time and energy that we've put into this is doing something and it feels worthwhile, right? Like all of it feels worthwhile. I know that that's true. The other piece of it honestly strikes me as a little bit scary, and scary because you recognize actually how very quickly you can have some amount of influence in somebody's thought process, and that it sticks with them and it changes a bunch of things. And with that knowledge, then the responsibility to be careful with that becomes, I don't know, a bit overwhelming.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I think it's freaky.
I say it warmed my heart. I'm proud. You say it's overwhelming, and God says that's kind of freaky.
Well, no, but it kind of is. I mean, yeah. It's like, I don't know. I just never imagined.
I mean, for me, I don't think it's all that freaky. Like I said, it's like I went away to college or something and came home. And so the part of me does feel sort of warm and fuzzy, like, oh yeah, like I really love everybody. This is a great crowd. These are my people. And at the same time, I'm also like really happy that, and I think this is deliberate because I went away to be in the leadership field, left the safety world. And there was a good reason for it, because leadership was a big part of our problem at Los Alamos. And now I kind of feel like, oh, you know what? I kind of have something different to contribute that they actually need. That was a big thing that people were talking about here. And I'm like, I can help. I accidentally went, you know, to this different place. And now I have something that I can give again. And it kind of feels good. It's kind of like, oh, you know, I went away. I went to college. I have a really weird family and I don't really call them much, but I show up for dinner occasionally. And then you come back and you're like, oh yeah, there's actually a place for me here.
Yeah, when did you also see your adopted new sibling? If this ever does get heard by anybody, I want them to know that as we're talking about this stuff, and if you have not met Martha, you have to meet her. She's as she's talking, she's smiling because you were foundational in this.
Oh, we need to be something. I mean, the first description of human performance, Martha made a slide. We should get that slide out. I'm sure I still have it. Mm-hmm. Where it was a maze with a mouse and cheese and a cat that walked backwards. I mean, it didn't really walk, but that was part of the story. And so you had the maze, which was the organizational system. The mouse was the employee. The cheese was clearly the production reward. And then the cat was Hazard. And she had this incredible, and we used it for, I mean, we definitely, it was a super fun slide to teach. And actually people really, it was a very good slide because people liked it.
It was, I guess it kind of was the beginning black line, blue line, but you took it out of my insane head that only thinks in pictures to something a little bit simpler.
The black
line. Because the blue line is, you know, the mouse trying to find its way through the maze. The black line is this, I think there was sort of a path in that maze. Yeah. That was like, here's the right solution. And that's what you think it is. But the mouse is trying to avoid the cat.
The origin story of that black line, blue line is the whiteboard next to the screen in Canyon 164.
All right.
Right. And I would draw. It's so funny, you guys, because Decker claims he started the black line, blue line. Hallnagel said he started the black line, blue line. And they all conceptually or certainly were there.
I mean, yeah. I mean, but, it's not like we didn't read all of their books before we taught those fundamentals classes.
And I promise you that the first time Decker saw the black line, blue line, he told me it was ridiculous. I should stop doing it. I was oversimplifying and I was implying linearity where there is no linearity. And I told him, well, the difference between me and you is that I can teach this stuff and you can't, which he was fine with. I mean, and I said, the one thing I wish we had was a special 3D whiteboard so we could make the blue line shoot out in all directions.
Yeah, and the red line.
Yeah. But I said, but we don't. And then Lisa, I mean, you and Lisa. Yeah. And I remember when Lisa came to me and they talked offline because this is, you know, we have a suggestion that we want to, we don't care what color, but we want a consistent, remember this?
I know, but we had already, like I said, we got to have some consistency here because it makes sense to people.
And see, and I'm anti-consistency because I didn't even really want to, I mean, I didn't want to do any of this. I did, I was.
But there weren't e-bikes available then, so you had to do something.
Yeah, no, it's true. Had there been e-bikes, there's no way I would have gone up Lafayette, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And I think you heard me pronounce it correctly.
Yes.
Lafayette, Georgia, where Bob would drive 1,000 miles each direction to work every morning. And then if that's not enough, he would park 1,000 miles away from the plant. Do you remember this?
No, I parked out my garden truck.
And you had the same car, and listeners, I'm not kidding, that Barbie drives. The first thing I asked Bob publicly in front of his staff is, did they sell men's cars where you bought that vehicle? So that's the old days where we could have that.
Yes.
Actually, I think the reason why a big part of why this all started is because you wouldn't take punishment. Because one thing that happened at Los Alamos is that we were both punished for our success. So I got a promotion and then got a team of, after having a team of 18 people, a team of 4 people who were all under some kind of supervisory program from HR.
Jail.
They were, yeah. And then they made you a special consultant and gave you nothing to do. And they thought that would, I mean, it totally punished me. I left, but you were like, you mean you gave me a title and you're paying me and I've got nothing to do? I think I'll just fly around the country. So he would go to all of these other DOE sites and he would train this and talk to people and solve problems just to keep himself amused. And what they really intended for us was for us to just sit in our offices with our noses against the corner until we conformed, until we realized that the nail that sticks up gets hammered down, but Todd can't be punished.
And you just wait out. The next director was
right. Was great.
A giant fan, and
yeah. But I mean, I think part of it is your personality that yeah. You're just like, someone wants to punish you, and you're like, great, I'll make the best of it.
It was kind of. Or this sort, getting this, it's a kind of a movement, and it's like, it's not a revolution, not a revolt.
I'm just shocked at where it is, because the weird thing about this meeting is there are meetings like this all around the world now.
I know.
I mean, all around the world.
I mean,
there's two or three in the United States that have more than 400 people.
Yeah. But this is cool. 600 people on the call.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think this was really cool. But they have there's a big one in Europe every year. South America's really into it now.
I know, right? And it, which also is really fun is, and you taught us this from the very beginning, be super generous.
Just give everything away.
Because it's that same little quote. What is it? Ralph Waldo Emerson?
There's no limit to how much change you can make if you don't care who gets the credit.
I love the last thing Andrea said. It's amazing how much change you can make if you don't care who gets the credit. That's cool. And I think that idea of generously moving forward and giving everything away, that should be the rule for all of us. And it kind of is. I mean, that's, I'm preaching to the choir, but even the choir practices on Wednesday nights. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed this. It's just a little glimpse inside. It was kind of weird. The audio's weird, but who cares? It's all good. And it's a chance to sort of hear some stuff, hear some stories and some background and some interesting behind the scenes, how the sausage is made. And you know, that's always interesting. Until then, learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. Be good to each other. Be kind to each other. And for goodness sakes, you guys, be safe.